Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet and Ed Burnham, joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. I've been up since 5:30 a.m., so I am ready to go.
You had your early morning media appearances to talk about the debate last night, I guess. So you have to get up early to prepare for all those things. Now, Frank, how many people candidates were on the stage at the debate last night?
Well, there were two candidates on stage last night. Thank you. Yep. Yes, there were two candidates. Donald Trump from the Republican Party and former Vice President Joe Biden from the Democratic Party.
Now, the reason why I bring that up, because I think it relates to the topic of our discussion today, because I'm looking right now at my ballot that I already completed for the state of North Carolina, which is where I'm a voter. And it lists more than two candidates here as people I could vote for president. It lists Donald Trump and it lists Joe Biden, but it also lists Don Blankenship as an option. I don't know who that is. It appears to be part of the Constitution Party. Howie Hawkins, does that name ring a bell to you? No, he is the Green Party candidate. Joe Jorgensen, who apparently is the Libertarian Party candidate. And a write-in option. So the question I have for you, Frank, is why aren't were those other people at the debate last night? Where was Joe Jorgensen? And why didn't we get a chance to hear from, I don't even know what the gender Joe Jorgensen has.
I don't know where Joe Jorgensen was last night. I'm sure that they were someplace doing something very worthy. did you say Joe Jorgensen was a libertarian?
Yes.
Right, so... Joe Jorgensen was probably outside, not benefiting from any kind of government intervention in his or her life. I don't know. Why weren't they there? They weren't there because they can't win. And this begs our question of today's theme, which is third parties. We had a question from a listener. Mark from Australia wrote to us after last week's episode, and Mark was one of several people who got in touch with us after last week's pop culture extravaganza. We had messages from Mike and Angus. I will say that my in-house critic Mimi was very pleased with the episode, despite the fact that I mentioned her and she doesn't like it when I mention her on the show. But Mark wrote to us and he actually had two suggestions for future episodes. One was looking at third parties and the other will keep us a mystery right now. We do take requests, so if you have any ideas, by all means, don't get in touch. But Mark wrote to us and he asked, why is it that third parties haven't succeeded in the United States? And so we're going to use that as our theme for this weekend. You're absolutely right, David. I sent my ballot in to Virginia, neighboring Virginia, to 2 weeks ago or a little more than 2 weeks ago. I don't remember who was on the ballot in addition to the president and Joe Biden, but I think Joe Jorgensen was on there. Who's the Blankenship guy?
Don Blankenship.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. He might have been on the ballot in Virginia as well. But yes, you always get these. Whenever you get a presidential ballot, there are always these other candidates listed.
Kanye is on the ballot in some states.
That's very exciting for him. but in general, and for most of American history, we've had a two-party system, and it's very, very difficult for third parties to get traction. And Mark's question, which is a good one, is, well, why is that? Why is that? So, David, why is that?
Well, I mean, I think there's, thinking about it both historically and contemporaneously, I think it might make sense to talk about sort of why two parties tend to dominate now. And there's some structural reasons for that, right? I think there's in a winner-take-all system that tends to gravitate towards having two parties that are somewhere relatively in the middle who sort of vie for 51% of the vote. So there's some sort of structural reasons that make it different from a parliamentary system, which tends to then sort of encourage, multiple parties and coalition parties and coalition governments. So I think that's part of the reason why you tend to have a plurality of political parties in Australia or in the UK or in Canada. It's because the sort of the structure of how elections work tends to do that. But I think there's some other sort of barriers today.
Yeah, although let me push back a little bit at that.
Okay, go ahead.
Because Americans often say this about parliamentary systems. First of all, we live in a country, well, the United Kingdom. We also live in a country, Scotland. So it is slightly complicated, and the Scottish dimension of this is complicated. However, in the UK, there really are, at the national level, I'm talking UK-wide at this point, there really are two parties. There are other parties.
The Liberal Democrats and the Greens are very upset with you.
Well, they are, but you know, in terms of who's likely to govern the country, and we tend to romanticize, especially Americans, in thinking about parliamentary systems. Oh, it's better in other countries because there's a greater spectrum of views mm-hmm. represented. And that's true to some extent. Belgium hasn't had a government, I think, in years because they're so hung up because of the difficulty of putting a coalition together. Sweden, which is a country whose politics I know pretty well, to some extent has an ongoing crisis because there's a pretty right-wing, anti-immigrant, xenophobic, not far off neo-Nazi party that's now commanding such a considerable proportion of the vote that the mainstream parties don't know how to deal with it. And that's causing a bit of a political crisis. So the fact that I'm here to speak up for the two-party system at some level, the fact that it can co-opt and absorb different points of view, one could argue is actually a virtue of the system, though we tend to think of it as lying behind the why don't third parties succeed is usually a critique of the system, saying there's something wrong with the system for that. And I'm not sure that's the case.
Oh, I'm with you on that. I was merely sort of articulating that the structure of the politics tends to gravitate towards two parties. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is, I guess, depending on what you think about the quality of the two choices you've got. But there's some other, I think, sort of barriers. I mean, you know, one obviously is getting on the ballot is not easy, right? That you have to get on 51 different ballots in order to, you know, really have a nationwide run. And you know, if you look at people who are the third party candidates who are running right now, I think like some of them are on the ballots in all 50 states. I think like the Libertarian Party might be, one or two others might be, but there's a lot of third party candidates today that were simply unable to get the requisite number of signatures by certain deadlines to get on the ballot in all the states. So the Green Party isn't on the ballot in every state. Kanye West's birthday party is not on the ballot in every state because he didn't meet the deadlines. All right.
Great name, actually.
Well, yeah, it's a good name for a party, you know. Yeah. Everything else about it's stupid, but you know, so there's some sort of structural barriers that the mainstream parties don't have.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, these are manifestations of the same phenomenon we're seeing with the difficulty of voting, because there's no uniformity across the system in the United States. You've got 51 concurrent elections, each with its own slightly different rules and regulations and requirements, and that makes it very difficult to operate at a national level unless you, both for individuals who mm-hmm. want to vote, candidates who want to run for office, and particularly if you want to run for national office. You're absolutely right.
Sure. And there's an argument that has been made and you hear third party candidates say this sometimes, that the two major parties have built the system to make it harder for third parties to get in and to sort of structure it to make it easy for, you know, there's no chance that Joe Biden or Donald Trump wouldn't be on the ballot in a particular state because the system is set up to have them on the ballot, but make it harder for third party candidates. Getting access to the debates is one of the ways in which the two parties sort of do that potentially. You know, in the past, they've set different thresholds for what, how much you have to be polling in order to get into a debate. But, you know, the fact that there were only two people on the stage last night, I think sort of reinforces the fact people thinking there's only two options when I guess my ballot tells me there were five or six.
So David, do you think the debate last night would have been better if Don Blankenship and Joe Jurgensen were there?
Oh, probably not. No, I mean,
represented a greater ideological spectrum. I mean, you've had the Libertarians and the Greens. There's a significant number of people in the United States who are actually libertarians. And similarly, you know, one can argue the environment is the number one issue facing humanity. And, you know, the Green Party's perspective would have been welcome.
Oh, to be sure. And thinking about the last election, Gary Johnson, who was the Libertarian candidate 4 years ago, he got nearly 5 million votes. Now, that doesn't translate into any electoral votes because of the peculiarities of the American system. But, you know, 5 million people is 5 million people. Jill Stein, who is the Green Party candidate, got 1.4 million votes, which is, you know, I guess when you're talking about a country with 300 million people, that's still not a, a huge number, but it's not nothing. So, you know, there are some ways in which being a third party candidate that you have some pretty significant barriers. That being said, if we look back at the, you know, past 200 years of elections, I think third parties actually have been a remarkably consistent part of American politics and have actually been, at least on the presidential level, they even if they haven't won the elections, they've shaped the elections in many ways. And there have been some key elections that were determined because there was a third party candidate there, right? And I think we can remember some of those in recent memories. We can think about the role that Ross Perot had in 1992 and 1996. You know, Bill Clinton won the election in 1992 in part because potentially Ross Perot took some votes away, you know, from George Herbert Walker Bush.
Let me endorse that. I don't think it's in part. I think that's a big part of, I think that, you know, Ross Perot got 18.6% of the vote, 19.7 million votes. Bill Clinton was a minority president. I think he only had 42% of the vote in the, overall. I'm pulling that out of the air, so I could be wrong about that. But the point being, you know, Ross Perot's votes. I think Ross Perot was a Texan. He really didn't like George H.W. Bush. He was very angry that George H.W. Bush broke his no new taxes pledge. And so I suspect that more of Perot's vote came from Bush voters.
Oh, to be sure. Yeah.
Bush voters than Democrats. And I think Ross Perot's candidacy is a big part of explaining Bill Clinton's success,
or in 2000, you know, obviously that was an extraordinarily close election, and there were a number of third party candidates, you know, including Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan, who got a larger segment of the vote in Florida than the difference between the two major party candidates.
That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, even a small percentage of people voting for third parties can make a difference. There were some people 4 years ago that were talking about how Gary Johnson could potentially be that sort of small window that would separate Donald Trump from Hillary Clinton. So, you know, even a third party candidate that doesn't win can shape the election in important ways.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's no doubt about that. In thinking about the history of this and thinking about, well, preparing for this episode, David, one of my reflections, and I say this with the utmost respect, is that it seems to me that third parties and really wackadoodle, nutty third party candidates are a kind of characteristic of electoral politics in your period, the kind of, with the rise of, and we've qualified this before, but kind of mass politics in the 1830s down to the 1880s, third party candidates are causing all kinds of mayhem. And there are some really weird and wacky ones. Is that fair?
I'm not sure they quite stop in 1880s. I think there's okay. Some that go well into the early part of the 20th century. I mean, obviously in the revolutionary era, the term party has this sort of negative connotation attached to it. And it largely sort of loses that sort of negative association by the time you get to sort of the Jacksonian period, where party becomes, you know, something worth fighting for. You know, and thinking through sort of the history of parties or third parties, you know, it strikes me, and third party candidates, it strikes me there's sort of three major sort of categories of them.
Yeah.
There's sort of parties that are single issue parties, right? We can think about like the Liberty Party, which was an anti-slavery party. We could think about the Greenback Party, which was interested in printing more paper money, which ran in four different presidential elections. We can think about the Prohibition Party, which wasn't a major party, but it was a consistent party, a party that for 40 years ran presidential candidates.
Yeah, their election parties were fun.
Well, actually, you know what? The Prohibition Party, believe it or not, is the third oldest party in the United States. They are running a candidate this year.
Do you know that candidate's name?
I do.
Sorry, not. I shouldn't have put you on the spot. That's unfair. I have no idea.
Okay, so they are running a candidate this year. He's not on the ballot in all 50 states. But they claim to be the third oldest party in the country. And they also have a mascot. You know, the Democrats are the donkey, the Republicans are the elephant. Do you know what the Prohibition Party's animal is?
You know that I don't.
That's fine. and it's actually assigned to them by the same cartoonist that assigned the two major parties their animals, Thomas Nast. They are the camel. Because they don't drink.
Camels don't drink.
So they are there. They have a camp. So that's your trivia, pub trivia quiz, Prohibition Party. But there, there are a series of parties like this that you know are primarily there towards focusing people's attention on one issue.
The anti-Masons.
Anti-Masons are a good example. They're probably, depending on how you want to think about these things, one of the first third parties, and they are focused on this one issue where they saw, Masons and other kinds of similar kinds of secret societies as being antithetical to American democracy. The Prohibition Party likewise thought that alcohol was the great threat to American society. The Liberty Party saw slavery as the great threat to both, human freedom, but also to American democracy. The Greenback Party, is likewise a similar issue, single issue party. So there's those. And, the thing about all of those parties really is clearly they didn't win the election, but they made those issues. They brought those issues to the forefront in important ways, right? That questions about slavery obviously became critically important. And some of the people who were in the Liberty Party later joined the Free Soil Party, who later became the foundations of the Republican Party. So that was really, an important kernel of what became a major political party. The Greenback Party, which was interested in currency expansion, which sounded really boring, but was critically important in the late 19th century. That became a major part of the populist movement that later became, incorporated into the major parties in the 20th century. Prohibition Party, we actually had prohibition for, a dozen years. So they were successful in that respect. So single issue parties, I think, do have an important role in terms of making the other major parties pay attention to a particular issue. Because even if they only get 1 or 2% of the vote, there's lots of close elections in American history, and 1 or 2% of the vote can matter. And if major parties want to attract those voters, that's a way to do it. I mean, the second category, I think, would be the sort of liberal alternative parties. And we've got two major parties which tend to be somewhat centrist, and people who think that those parties should move to the left. And we have the Populist Party in 1892 sort of is sort of one manifestation of that, where people were pushing for a more radical set of reforms. But then even more importantly, the Socialist Party runs candidates in the United States for 30 years. And obviously they never win, but they often finish third. And they often finish there with a significant number of votes. Eugene Debs got 1 million votes.
And do you think
ran for president 5 times? So,
with reference to that, Debs's successor is very much Bernie Sanders, right?
I was thinking he was Norman Thomas, but yes, Bernie Sanders is the contemporary successor.
In electoral terms.
Yes.
But what's interesting about Sanders, although, he doesn't, he's not formally a Democrat. He caucuses with the Democrats. He ran for the Democratic nomination both this time and in 2016. So does the fact that Sanders is a Democrat in all but name, what does that say as far as this typology of yours, that there is, is this an example of the Democrats co-opting a movement, or is it, unique to Sanders?
Oh, I think what happens oftentimes with these third parties is that the major parties take these ideas and run with them, right? And the example that occurs to me, that happens sometimes with the socialists, but it happens even more with the populists, the People's Party. When they ran in 1892, they had a series of ideas having to do with increasing the currency, having to do with direct election of senators, having to do with various kinds of government control and regulation of industry. And the Democratic Party largely co-opted many of those ideas, so much so that the populists, at least part of the populists, endorsed the Democratic candidate in 1896 and the Cross of Gold and William Jennings Bryan and all that.
I mean, arguably, Bryan is the most successful third party candidate in history because he becomes a major party candidate. He's co-opted
but he was really a Democrat who was endorsed by the populists. But those ideas, which began as a set of ideas that were associated with the third party, since it became so attractive, the Democratic Party sort of latched onto them, and those became, not only ideas associated with electoral politics, but many of those came to fruition. We do have a direct election of senators. We do have an income tax. We do have these ideas that the populists were putting forward as a sort of fringe movement in 1892 becomes mainstream by the time you get to the 20th century. And I think with Bernie Sanders and sort of thinking about the role that he's played in the past two elections, he has pushed the other Democratic candidates to address these more leftist ideas. He's caused the party as a whole to move slightly to the left. I mean, it's only very slightly to the left from my reading of it, but questions about Medicare for all, questions about the environment and what have you, those are issues that probably Joe Biden wouldn't have wanted to have to sort of address maybe as much as he has during the campaign. So it's changed the discussion, which I think is in part of what the role that third parties have played, both with the single issue parties and these sort of liberal alternatives.
Before you get to your third category, I want to push back again slightly on your characterization of the two parties as being mainstream and the two mainstream party as being centrist. I think that used to be true. I'm not so sure it's as true anymore. I think the Democrats have moved to the left, and I think the Republicans have moved to the right. I mean, it used to be, when I got to Europe now almost 30 years ago, people would say, oh, there's no difference between the two main political parties in America.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
You can't say that anymore. I mean, I think that the center of gravity in each party has moved to the left and right respectively a considerable degree.
Oh, I would agree with that. No, you're 100% right about that. This is very different than it was 20 years ago, where, part of the appeal of Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan for voters in Florida in 2000 was that Gore and Bush were not as sufficiently distinct from one another as some of those voters wanted them to be. And they wanted a real third alternative.
Yes, if you voted for Pat Buchanan 20 years ago, you don't have to seek an alternative outside of either of the political parties. Donald Trump is running on Pat Buchanan's platform.
It's when the two parties get closest together that the third parties have the most appeal.
Right.
Right. Even though there are third party candidates on the ballot this year, I don't think they have nearly as much of appeal to voters as they may have had in other elections, in part because we know this is going to be a very close election. We know this is going to be a very consequential election. The difference between 4 more years of Donald Trump and 4 years/potentially 8 years of Joe Biden is going to be a meaningful difference. It's when voters look at the two main party candidates and say, I don't really see a difference between these two, and I don't really like either of them, that they are likely to gravitate towards a third party.
And Bernie's made that clear. I mean, Bernie's support, his fulsome support of Biden is indicative of that. He's more or less said, look, I know we might have our differences, but these are the stakes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, when you look back at these other parties, when we look at sort of the Populist Party or the Socialist Party, the reason why those parties were successful to the extent that they were is because the two major parties weren't addressing some major segment of the populists, some big issues, and were largely indistinguishable on tax policy or social policy, but something else.
So what's your third category?
Third category are parties that aren't really parties, but are parties that are based around individual people.
Like the birthday party with Kanye West.
Like the birthday party. Like, there's nobody else who can be the birthday party candidate besides Kanye, but you know, who else could possibly hope to? But when we think about sort of third party candidacies, there's a number of parties that emerge really for one election that are centered around a particular person. Often this is a person who is sort of fragmented or alienated from one of the major parties. So we think of the Bull Moose Party from 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt runs originally as a Republican, but then because of the structure of the Republican Party in 1912, he loses the primary, he loses the nomination to Taft, and he runs the third party, and you end up with Woodrow Wilson. Perot and the Reform Party, George Wallace and the American Independent Party. I put Strom Thurmond in the Dixiecrat Party from 48 in here, where, you know, Strom Thurmond was a Democrat and he says, like, I don't feel welcome in the Democratic Party at this particular moment, so I'm going to have my own party for one election, then it becomes Republican. John Anderson in 1980, I'd sort of put in this category where, as far as I know, he didn't even have a party. It was just him.
He was just John Anderson running for president.
But, you know, he was a Republican and he had run the Republican primary and not won there, but decided to run against Carter and Reagan in 1980 as a third party and did, you know, for a third party candidate, remarkably well.
So let me ask you something, David, with this, yes, this typology, and I think it's compelling. The personality candidates, on one hand, have the least ideological commitment. I mean, they have ideologies they believe in, yeah, but I think you're right. Their candidacies, to some extent, are driven by their own personalities. And in some cases, Ross Perot, Teddy Roosevelt, these are quite significant people in terms of their purchase on popular attention.
Yeah.
And thus they've influenced the outcome of elections. Are the, which category has had the greatest impact in shaping electoral outcomes? I guess that's my question. Is it the individuals or the people running on issues that eventually kind of are co-opted by one of the major parties and change the party policies and platforms?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think in terms of the out elections, the sort of third category of magic people who are running for basically for themselves and creating parties, they've had the biggest impact on who wins. Right. So if we think about 1912, you know, the Republican Party had been dominating the races for the White House in various degrees ever since the Civil War. And we end up with a, you know, Southern Democrat in the form of Woodrow Wilson winning because Teddy Roosevelt splits the Republican Party vote. Likewise, we mentioned with Perot, he splits the Republican Party vote in 1992. You know, George Wallace was not an insignificant figure in 68.
No, he won five states.
It's right, you know, and I think that had shaped both that election and subsequent elections, because people were worried about what would happen if he were to run again and how does that play into sort of the racial politics of the 1970s. So I think that they're actually, you know, thinking about the electoral outcomes, what happens on election day and who takes office. I think that third category is the most influential. On the other hand, you know, these sort of ideological parties, these single issue parties, they do really actually shape the discussion in very long-term important ways. And so I don't think we should count them out.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's correct. So these individuals can affect a particular election, but I think the ideological parties do more to shape the electoral environment more generally and the partisan environment in the country. Let me put a provocative question to you, David.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Or a statement to you and ask for your response as a historian of the Civil War era. Isn't the most successful third party candidate in history Abraham Lincoln in 1860?
That depends on how you number the parties, I guess.
But let me explain my reasoning behind this.
Okay.
We think of the two parties as the Democrats and Republicans, of course. And the Republicans' first national victory is in 1860 with Nixon. With Lincoln. God, forgive me. with Lincoln. And so we kind of project back and give them retrospective major party status as of 1860, when, as you know better than me, So the Democrats were well established under Jackson. The Whig Party falls apart. So there was a second party, but it was the Whig Party. And then there's this kind of churn for a decade or so, or almost 20 years, of various parties, the Know-Nothings, challenging to become that second party. And that's the party that will emerge from that is the Republicans. That's not necessarily clear in 1860 when Lincoln is running. And so arguably Lincoln is a third party candidate in the sense that there was one major party and a bunch of other parties. And he is, therefore, I posit to you that he's so successful the Republicans become a major party, so we don't think of it in those terms. So respond.
Okay, so I have a bunch of thoughts. One of the things about American politics is that the two parties that we have, two major parties we have today, have been remarkably stable despite various kinds of threats for more than 150 years. But that if you look at the first half of American history, that the party system it was much more dynamic than it has been ever since then. So, we've got the first party system with the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, if that's what you want to call them. And then you've got the second party system with the Democrats and the Whigs, and it seemed like every generation you were going to have a reshuffling of the structure of the party and the distributions of the parties and the identities of the parties. And it's interesting that hasn't happened, in 150 years, even if the parties themselves have the same names and have a lineage that goes back a long time. The two parties themselves have ideologically very little to do with the parties and the labels that they've inherited. And where the Republican Party emerges out of this, and thinking about its origins, there was in the second party system, the Democrats and the Whigs, and both the Democrats and the Whigs end up collapsing to a certain degree over the question of slavery and slavery in the West and how they're able to sort of create a national platform over that. And the Whig Party collapses first, really after 1852, and two parties sort of move in to take their place, as you point out. The American Party, which nobody ever calls the American Party, it's the Know-Nothing Party, which is this anti-immigrant party, and the Republican Party, which was a party that was hostile to slavery in the West, expansion of slavery into the territories. I think by 1856, the Republican Party has established itself as a second party under Fremont. So I think by the time Lincoln runs, it's an established second party. What happens in 1860, though, is in fact there are four candidates for president because the Democratic Party splits, and there's a fourth candidate, the Constitutional Union Party under Bell, which has a very strange and short history. So I wouldn't classify Lincoln. I think by 1860, the Republican Party is an established, even if it's not very old, second party. But I think it's at a point in which the parties were very dynamic, and you can imagine a scenario in which the Republican Party, didn't hold on to maintain its status as a major party if Lincoln hadn't won that election, for instance.
Now this is even more absurd as a kind of counterfactual. If there's no war, does the American Party, emerge and preempt or take that second spot?
Well, when the Whig Party collapsed, there was earlier in the 1850s, there were many people who thought the American Party was going to emerge as the second major party, in part because they spoke to this issue that many Americans cared about, the question about immigration and how, especially Irish and Catholic immigration and California Chinese immigration was going to reshape the American polity and whether those immigrant groups were compatible with the Republican systems of government. And the American Party actually did remarkably well at the state and local election. One thing to think about with third parties is sometimes third parties are actually successful at a local level, even if they aren't successful at a national level. you know, but they proved once they were actually in office that they were not particularly effective, right? So you know, the American Party, the Nenorthian Party, rose and fell very, very quickly, such that by 1860, the party was effectively dead or co-opted into other parties.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Lincoln's not a third party candidate.
I think he's, but now Fremont, you know, who ran for the Republican nomination 4 years earlier, I would see him as potentially a third party candidate, or at least he's one of two new parties that's vying to become a second major party.
Right. In 1856, it was either outcome was a plausible.
I think that seems reasonable. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So then to fast forward to the present, because we often get asked, or people like to talk about whether it's possible that another party could emerge. What do you think about in response to that? I have my own views, but I'd rather hear yours first.
So that's a really good question. And, you know, thinking about how do new parties emerge, and sometimes new parties can emerge from sort of outside the existing political system. And sometimes new parties emerge when existing parties split, right? And what strikes me as more likely right now is that I could envision one of the major parties right now splitting over some kind of ideological issue and forming a third party in that respect. One can imagine, you know, the Republican Party right now, the sort of the Trump wing of the Republican Party splitting off from the other part of the Republican Party. But it's very hard, you know, given how much power the parties have and how much money the parties have, it's hard to imagine how third parties could be formed in this current moment. What do you think?
I agree with you. I think the institutional obstacles are considerable. I think what we may be about to see is a kind of new realignment, or not new realignment, realignment by definition is new, a realignment going on, not dissimilar to what happened in the 20s and 30s when the parties kind of began to change and assume their modern positions, if you will. And I'm greatly simplifying a complicated process, but it seems to me, had Hillary Clinton won in 2016, so after the Republicans lost in 2012, they famously had that kind of autopsy, and there was a postmortem report produced by the group that got together to look at that defeat and said, look, we really need to do more outreach for, particularly to minority voters in a country that's becoming increasingly diverse and in which whites will soon be the largest minority group. And that was shelved largely because of the advent of President Trump, where instead what they did was lean into white, particularly white non-college educated voters as a kind of base and played to them. And that worked in 2016. It remains to be seen whether it will work this time. The polls would suggest it may not, but it may, you know, it might work. It's still not a long-term winner, just given the changing demography of the country. So it seems to me that there's a reckoning coming within the Republican Party on the issue of identity politics and immigration and things like that. So it seems to me that that's reasonable. Whether the party will split between Trumpists and non-Trumpists, or whether, as we've seen with the Lincoln Project, will those people who are currently supporting Joe Biden move back to the Republican Party, assuming Biden wins, and you know, lead the opposition, and then there'll be a fight within the Republican Party, or will they become the conservative wing of the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party will become something else? But I think, for the kind of structural reasons you mentioned, I think we'll still have the two parties with these names. I don't think they're going to look exactly the way they look today, 10 or 12 years from now. I think we're in the middle of a realignment and kind of shifting that's going on, and we've proven repeatedly that we're not very good at predicting the future. I don't know exactly what it will look like.
We just don't
have
the right time horizon, Frank.
Exactly.
Far enough in the future, we're right.
That's right. So I think there's a realignment coming first in the Republican Party, because it's most acute there, especially if they lose the White House this time. But by definition, because you have a two-party system, a realignment in one of the parties will lead to a realignment in the other party as well. So I think it's a very interesting time for political scientists. But I don't think it'll be a fracturing like the death of the Whigs in the 1830s and 40s, and they'll be replaced by something new. Maybe it could happen, but I don't think it'll go like that, because to some extent, brand names matter.
Oh, yeah, to be sure.
and the fact that these parties have lineages, they're two of the oldest political parties in the world, and arguably in institutional terms have been quite successful because they've been able to reinvent themselves. But I think if it's not a real, I think it's not just a realignment, it'll be a reinvention that's going to happen in the aftermath. And if the Democrats were to lose, they'll have to go back and say, okay, we've now lost twice in a row to a party that's, or a candidate who's embraced white nationalism. How can we respond to that in a way that will be effective? So I think we're in the midst of a period of change, is my long-winded answer. Sorry.
I mean, I think there's also potential for a kind of a realign or a splitting of the Democratic Party, you know, because I think there's a range of political views that are expressed within the Democratic Party right now. And what, you know, the Democrat who could be successful in Alabama and what the Democrat who could be successful in California, what they have in common is relatively limited, at least in terms of, you know, policy issues, you know, whether it's environmental policy, whether it's, you know, tax policy, healthcare policy, the overlap there is relatively limited. And one could see the Democratic Party splitting in a similar kind of way, where you've got sort of a centrist part of the Democratic Party that runs in Alabama and West Virginia, and a sort of more coastal Democratic version of the Democratic Party that is more progressive on issues. Sort of the Bernie Sanders wing.
That's right. I think you're right about that. Especially if the Democrats win big, then it becomes a very big tent. But that also means it's a tent that has a disparate group of people within it, and right. That does make it that will pose its own challenges. I think that's right. I think one of the consequences of the centers of gravity of the two parties moving to the left and right, respectively, is that means that the people on either side of those parties, to the further left and right, are clamoring for a bigger voice.
Yeah.
And then what we'll get inevitably is, you know, we'll get the kind of Bill Clinton of the 2040s who calls for a centrist revival of some kind, and reaching out in a third way, to use Tony Blair's language, you know, because there's an ebb and flow to these things.
Okay, so when Chelsea runs,
that's right. When Chelsea runs against AOC.
Or Ivanka, yes, exactly. Oh. You know, yeah, that'll be the primary and the general, right? Good. So, I mean, odds are, I think we're going to continue to have third parties be a player in American politics. You know, there's every year there's discussions about, you know, a billionaire or something, you know, entering the race as a third party candidate. You hear different names of, you know, Bloomberg has been floated in the past couple of elections. I've heard other various kinds of figures like that being tossed and hadn't have their hat tossed in the ring for them.
I guess there's an interesting contrast, though, because Bloomberg, of course, ran for the Democratic nomination, didn't win it, and then accepted that defeat and put some money into supporting Joe Biden. Whereas Ross Perot, you know, who was a Bloomberg type figure, a diminutive billionaire, you know, decided to run on his own and ran twice, you know,
to be sure, yeah,
as a kind of exercise in megalomania.
Yeah. But I think it says something that the most successful, in some ways, third party candidates have all been eccentric billionaires. Is at least in recent memory, says something about how hard it is, in some ways, to do this. That the only people who can able to get in the system to work for them are people who can sort of buy their way in.
Well, and this goes to your point earlier, David, about the institutional obstacles. So it'd be very difficult for somewhat of a kind of middle class background to just decide to start a third party and succeed. And that happened in the 19th century.
Century, oh, to be sure.
But now you know, so the next billionaire who would have the kind of clout to run, have the profile, have be able to create their own media infrastructure, somebody like Jeff Bezos, I suppose.
Or Kanye.
Or Kanye. Sorry,
we brought from Kanye. That's all my fault.
I haven't given the birthday party enough respect, David, today. I'm sorry. But it'll be somebody like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Presumably, rather than a kind of grassroots movement that creates a third party, I guess, because the financial and institutional obstacles are so great, it would have to be basically a plutocrat.
I think that's right, which is something of an indictment of the system, I think. But that not everybody can grow up to be president unless they play by the rules of the two major parties. Right. Well, we will see how this unfolds. Obviously, I think in this election, third parties aren't going to be a major factor unless things are super close, which they may be, because that's the way things are right now. But in the future, I think there's a likelihood that we will see a resurgence of third parties and them playing a major role in American politics.
Thanks for the question, Mark.
Yes. You have a last drop, Frank.
Well, speaking of exercises in megalomania...
It's a podcast, Frank. It's the entire thing is an exercise in megalomania.
On a miniature level. Oh, yes, I want to endorse the Ben Franklin's World podcast, which will be well known to many of you. And I know it's well known to you, David. You're a listener. It's an early American podcast, which is done by our friend Liz Covert. And it's sponsored by the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture. The reason I'm endorsing it this week, however, is because they're doing a series of episodes in the run-up to the election. And I am on one next week that's going to drop next week, one of these on early American politics. And I want to thank Joe Adelman, who interviewed me for that. And so this is an exercise in self-promotion for which I apologize, though. I reckon that none of our listeners who stayed with us this long will be surprised by this. So the podcast itself is great, but I'm going to be on one, so be warned. Okay.
So if you want more Frank in your life, you get him on this show, you get him on the BBC Scotland, you're going to be on Ben Franklin's World. It's all Frank all the time. That's great. Okay. Hours and hours of listening pleasure.
David, what's your last drop?
Well, on a similar sort of log rolling kind of theme, we're going to be doing a live show next week with the History Society on Wednesday at 7 p.m. UK time. We've done a number of live shows, or a few live shows in the past, but this one is going to be live on Zoom. So we're going to be taking questions from the History Society. Obviously, this will be right before the election, so I'm imagining a lot of them will be election related. But I think we'll take questions about anything, because that's, you know.
So that's the Edinburgh University History Society.
The Edinburgh University History Society. They are an amazing student organization. They do lots of great stuff. They do academic stuff. They do social stuff. They've got sports teams. But they've had us do a live show before. We did a live show with them 2 years ago, something like that.
And is this open on Zoom, David, or is it?
I think you have to RSVP with their Facebook group, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But if you are, like them on Facebook, and you can probably sneak in somehow to the live show, ask us some difficult questions, because we like to be challenged.
We certainly are challenging, that's for sure.
All right.
All right, David.
Until then, Frank, cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.